Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So this is the week the Internal Market Bill goes to votes in the Commons, the first of 2 weeks, and we're hearing of a growing Tory rebellion. After murmurs of discontent last week, Geoffrey Cox has set the agenda using an editor in the Times to explain why he cannot back the government. James, are we looking at a looming Commons defeat for the government?
No, I don't think we're looking at a Commons defeat. I think we are looking at an embarrassing rebellion, which I don't think is going to be big enough to overturn the government's majority, but will I think be significant enough to embolden the House of Lords in its opposition to the bill. I mean, the importance of a Geoffrey Cox op-ed is twofold. The first is that this is another Brexiteer lawyer saying that they don't think that this plan is acceptable, following on from Michael Howard. And that moves the debate away from the Leave Remain frame that Downing Street would like it to be seen through, onto one about international law, treaty obligations, all that kind of stuff, where Downing Street is on much less certain ground because of the very explicit way in which Brandon Lewis, in their own briefing, talked about what this meant in international law terms. The second point is that Geoffrey Cox was Boris Johnson's first Attorney General. And I think it was sensed at the time that when he was replaced by Suella Braverman, that was a sign that Downing Street wanted a bit more, someone slightly less independent-minded in that job. But I think that because he was Boris Johnson's first Attorney General, I think there will be a fair few Tory MPs who are on the fence about this, who are more likely to find a reason not to be in the House of Commons when this thing comes to a vote. But my personal sense is that this week, there isn't going to be some massive rebellion. It's next week on this Bob Neil amendment about giving the House of Commons a vote before these clauses came into effect. That is where I think you will see more Tory rebels than on any of the votes this week.
And Fraser, if we're looking ahead to next week as the crunch week for potential problems for the government on the Internal Market Bill, that's a long time to go in terms of days in politics. And we saw on Friday when Boris Johnson addressed MPs in his own party on a rather wearying Zoom call that actually you can lose morale quite quickly. So do you think there is space for things to change and the government to actually get close to losing a vote by next week?
I wouldn't say it's likely to lose the vote. For a government with a majority of 80 to lose not just any vote, but the key Brexit vote it's trying to get through would be just a disaster. I think you'll get, I don't know, a dozen, maybe 20 rebels if they're unlucky. But to end up back in Theresa May territory of a government trying to negotiate Brexit but unable to do so because Parliament wouldn't let it would just be devastating for the Conservative Party collectively. So I don't think it will come to that. But there is the potential for things to get a lot worse. I mean, we had a disaster, the Brandon Lewis declaration last week that he intended to break international law in a limited and specific way. That was an unforced error. And right now, I'm afraid to say, we seem to be in the habit of seeing government unforced errors. So probably a few more of these. There seems to be a general coordination issue, a general lack of grip. But I don't think yet it will mean that the government doesn't get its way.
James, do you think senior figures in Downing Street now regret the way that Brandon Lewis spoke about breaking international law? Do you think they stand by that as a tactic?
One of the objections you hear from lots of the rebels is, by stating it that boldly, Downing Street left them in a very uncomfortable position, because by backing these provisions in the bill, you were essentially saying, yeah, let's do this, let's break international law in a specific and limited way. I mean, the line out of Downing Street is still, oh, you couldn't mislead Parliament, so you had to say something like that. But I think there is beginning to be a sense among some of those around the Prime Minister that there might have been a better way of saying this. That, you know, it might have been better to make clear, as Robert Buckland tried to do yesterday, this is about reserving the right to do something if something were to happen. And I think there is a feeling that the boldness of that statement, which was Brandon Lewis wasn't freelancing here, this was in the official script, the boldness of that statement has made the UK look like it's crossing the road for a fight, rather than it is responding to something that the EU is doing. Now, yesterday you had David Frost and Michel Barnier dueling on Twitter, exchanges that you can read on the Spectator's website. And you know, there, David Frost is trying to make the argument that if you won't list the UK as a third country for agricultural exports, you're basically making it impossible for food to go from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. But the point is, what lots of Tory MPs are complaining about is none of these arguments were out there before Brandon Lewis said what he said. So instead, Brandon Lewis' intervention kind of came from a kind of clear blue sky rather than there being any preparing of the ground for such a dramatic statement.
Fraser, in other news, we are now living in the world of the rule of six. The rule of six has come into force today. And again, the papers have all the reports that we could be heading to a potential 10 p.m. curfew. In the Telegraph, there's a suggestion that this is apparently the next logical step. We've also hearing it from Patrick Vallance through a private email that he, the chief scientific officer, argued for stronger than anyone for harsh restrictions early on in the crisis. Do you think that we're beginning to see here some of the dynamics and the big decisions we're seeing, or at least look ahead to what the inquiry is going to look like?
Yes, I think it was quite significant to see the Patrick Vallance email leak. This is an email he sent the day before the Sunday Times did an Insight expose, which wasn't really an expose. I saw it more as a sort of a Neil Ferguson hit job. It was a theory that the number of COVID cases were rising exponentially up until the day before lockdown. And then when lockdown was implemented on the 23rd of March, the number of cases fell. The accusation, and a very, very strong one from Neil Ferguson, was that delaying even by a week cost a lot more lives because the virus was growing in an exponential way. When I saw this, the first thing that I thought was, well, this is incorrect. This was Neil Ferguson's theory back in the day, where he came up with a desk exercise, where he made a few hypotheses, some of which we now know to be incorrect. He's assumed, for example, that this was a novel virus, therefore there was no inbuilt resistance. We've since had at least three or four major studies showing that people do have resistance to this through the T cell with previous exposure to coronavirus. But more importantly, we now know when the virus peaked. We know that because people, including Simon Wood at Bristol University, have done studies basically backdating it from the deaths. And it seems that the virus peaked about a week before lockdown. So by the time lockdown happened on the 23rd of March, the virus was on its way out quite quickly. Now, Patrick Vallance, if he had believed that or known that, ought to have been saying, yes, the Sunday Times article is on a false premise. We should be pointing it out. The R number was probably a 1 at the time of lockdown. Therefore, it was not rising. But instead, in this email, Vallance seems to be saying, well, don't blame me because I was arguing for lockdown before anyone else. So already you're getting into this rather defensive kind of arse-covering mentality. You can see here on this email of the 23rd of May, Patrick Vallance already preparing for the inquiry. Now, this is my general concern about Sage right now. We had a very powerful article by Oxford's Carl Hennigan in the website over the weekend saying that our COVID response is being designed and implemented by people without any real experience in the field of epidemiology. Therefore, they're panicking. They're confusing mathematical models with real-life data, and they're still blind to what the real-life data is telling them. What the real-life data says is if you can go back and do the history of Britain, cases were coming down before lockdown, but they still seem to be wedded to the Neil Ferguson hypothesis that lockdown is the tool, and perhaps the only tool, that suppresses the virus. Now, if that's the way they're looking at it, then what we can expect in coming days and months is this tool to be used again and again. So we do not have a Swedish-style approach to this, as we initially did. We have got a Sage committee that's worried about the inquiry. We've got Patrick Vallance, who believes in the tool of lockdown. So I think it stands to reason we can expect further lockdown measures like curfews.
James, when we talk about decision-making in terms of coronavirus, it's often Matt Hancock versus the rest of the cabinet that was said in the reports of the weekend. But I suppose to understand why Boris Johnson makes the decisions that he does, which are often more cautious than most in his party one, do you think Patrick Vallance and Sage are a very big part of that?
I think that Boris Johnson is deeply conflicted on COVID. His natural disposition would be to be the kind of person saying, come on, everyone, let's get back out there, let's get back, try and get back to normal. But I think the first experience when the UK had such a high excess death toll, I think it is a semi-open secret that I think come the inquiry, Boris Johnson will admit a regret that there was no earlier lockdown. And so I think that is where he is going. I think that, you know, ultimately, number 10 are driving this caution about the virus and what happens to it. I think if you look at their view, if you look, and all this is in plain sight, you know, if you look at the Downing Street press conference to announce these new restrictions, Chris Whitty is saying that there's France and there's Belgium. We want to be Belgium, not France. And they credit Belgium's flattening of the curve to the very hardcore approach they took to face masks, that lockdown in Antwerp that was more severe than anything we had even at the peak of lockdown here. So I think you are looking at a kind of interesting dilemma here. And then I think there is another question, which is, you know, people are getting fatigue of this. And I mean, that's certainly true in the Tory parliamentary party, but there is a kind of like, how much longer can people live their lives like this? I mean, it's becoming a kind of a growing concern. I think that the first experience of it means that I really think he is not been going to be prepared to take the risk of saying the NHS has this capacity. Let's go back to the original strategy of just keeping this virus within the capacity of the NHS to deal with it.
It's also striking that I think the Belgian authorities have recorded a rise in coronavirus last week. It's like a 15% increase in positive tests. And that's being put down to the fact that they released these restrictions. So if we're following the Belgian model, then this really is the British government adopting far more of a suppression strategy than they've ever admitted to so far. And to me, this is the great missing question. Is this what they're doing? Are we now in an environment where the government wants to reduce the number of cases because it is convinced that it will lead to a second wave? It might sound like it's stating the obvious, but that's the opposite to what the Swedes believed. Now, the Swedes are now celebrating the end of the virus there. They're off the quarantine list. They're lifting the cap on the number of meetings to 500 against our 6, because they took a very different approach to it. Now, fair enough, though, the British government might believe that there are no lessons to learn in Sweden and the Belgian is the way ahead. But again, if it is, we ought to be told a lot more about this than we are right now, which makes the case for a lot more parliamentary scrutiny than we're getting.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.